really the most important articles he wrote about the concept of emunah. He very much focused on the role that Rebbeim had in giving the Talmidim emunah. And in there he spoke very beautifully, eloquently, famously about his relationship with his three Rebbeim. And when I was about your age and first read that article, I took many things from that one-page article initially as it was published in the Jewish Action magazine. Importance of emunah, the role of Rebbeim in emunah, the importance sometimes of having even more than one Rebbe, the different relationships you can have. But I was thinking, as we introduce Rabbi Willig to speak about one of his Rebbeim, Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal, what is the difference between sitting in someone's shir and having a Rebbe? Just because you hear shir from somebody does not make you a Talmud. That's something you have to earn. That's also a status. But it doesn't necessarily make that person your Rebbe. What makes a person a Rebbe as opposed to just having a relationship as a Magid shir? So I think the answer is very, very simple. From the perspective of the Rebbe, I'm talking now, not the perspective of the Talmud, from the perspective of the Rebbe, and that is the personal relationship. A human, the Naram L'Chavero relationship outside of the Gemara, outside of the Shulchan Aruch. You know, the Gemara very famously talks about with a famous Maimer Chazal, which I'm sure you've all heard of. Even sometimes you get in trouble with your parents when you come home from school, in elementary school, and you tell them you learned this in Parsha, about the difference between your parents or your father and your Rebbe. And let's say there's a Hashavas Aveda, there's a lost object, the Shana Bet Boys we learned Bava Metzia last year. So if you have a lost object of your father and your Rebbe, which one comes first? And the Gemara says that you're supposed to give your Rebbe, return your Rebbe's lost object first, you should put effort into that before your own father. Because then maybe you'll olam hazeh, which you have to have a karsa tov and respect to your father for. But zem if you olam haba. But if the Rebbe is going to help give you Torah and give you your shamayim, going to bring you to olam haba, so that's even more important. So part of the misconception and the misapplication of that Gemara is because, as the Pisrei Tshuva and others point out, if you have a father who either supports your learning, so he also is maybe you olam haba, but sometimes, some of us are zochah, not only to have a father who supports us and sends us to yeshiva and pays tuition, we have a father or a mother who learn Torah with us, who teach us Torah. And then that parent has the din of not only being the parent, biologically, but also the Rebbe. Doesn't mean they have to be your main Rebbe. But once the parent is involved, also mevi l'olam haba, so then that's already gives the mevi l'olam hazeh and olam haba as to supersede. So I was thinking that I think the inverse is simply and obviously true as well. If you have a Rebbe who doesn't just give you shiurim and nice lomdas or answer your shilohs, but loves you like a son, who treats you and cares for you and helps you the same way that your parents do, then that Rebbe also has a bechina, not only of a Rebbe mevil olam haba, but as an av who's mevil olam hazeh, they help you in this world as well. If the father can attain the status of a Rebbe by teaching you a little Torah, I think it's to me, the Rebbe can also attain the status of a parent by helping you Ba'olam Hazeb. I won't bore you, it's not the time or the place, but like countless other Talmidim of Rabbi Willig, I have innumerable, tens, maybe already three digits, personal stories where Rabbi Willig, not only all the Torah he's taught me, all the Psakim, all the Hadracha and Halacha, but where he treated me like a son and helped me Meviel Olam Hazeb. Not just Meviel Olam Haba. I even remember once coming to the Y-Bais Medrash thanking him for something he did, Agaf, with my parents and my sister. And I was astounded at the chesed he did. And he looked at me like I was crazy. He's done that more than once. And said, this is, what do you, he looked at me. I remember the corner of the old Y-Bais Medrash. He says, this is what it means to be a Rebbe. You want to just sit and learn, stay in Kolo. But you want to be a Rebbe, that means helping people and being involved in their lives. And one of the great Rebbeim that Rabbi Willig had was Rav Lichtenstein. And Rav Lichtenstein, we know, such a legacy in the yeshiva. We've spoken a lot last year for the Shana Bet guys and this year about being part of that legacy, even though Rav Lichtenstein physically was no longer with us. But Sisosos Dovos Mekever, he's very much alive in this Beis Medrash and this yeshiva. And he wasn't just a Magid Shir to your Rebbeim. He was a true Rebbe in every sense of the word, to so many of the Ramim and Rebbeim here, and many Rebbeim, Rosh Hashivas, and Wayu, and throughout the world, including Rabbi Willig. And therefore, to have Rabbi Willig, someone who, with his own Talmidim, exemplifies what it means to be a Rebbe, to speak about his Rebbe, Rav Lichtenstein, I can't think of a better and more appropriate treat for us. And without further ado, b'chavod, my Rabbi, Rabbi Willie.
I have to preface my remarks after denying what Rabbi Gottlieb said by my feelings of inadequacy for this particular mandate. I didn't give this introduction to my shiur on drama and psikresha, even though I don't know how good it was, but you know, that was okay. To come to speak about a Torah giant or the proportions of Arena of Aaron Lichtenstein Tzatzal, that's something which is a much more difficult assignment. And b'miyuchad, especially the Asrei in his yeshiva. When the news came to the United States of the Patira, I believe it was Rosh Chodesh Iyar, if I'm not mistaken, I received a call that very day, as soon as the news broke in our yeshiva, to please come that very night to give the Rehesped in the community of Passaic. And there, it was not Asrei, it was not his place, in more ways than one. And I felt an imperative to just come. He asked to come. I didn't think twice. Came to the shul. I think it was in the Aguda, if I'm not mistaken. Rabbi Sachs' shul, I think so. And we said what I had to say. And since Rabbi David apparently heard it on tape and thought that the subject matter was appropriate for Talmidim who knew Rav Lichtenstein only after he moved to this holy land, which is the vast majority, that the perspective that I had as the one who learned with him in America would be helpful even by Asrei, even in the place in his yeshiva where he was so well known for the years he spent here since going to Aliyah back in 1971. So I will focus, at least initially, on the years previous. Rav Lichtenstein would often complain about what he called, if he didn't use that exact word, vanilla hespedim. Hespedim could be interchangeable. You have two rabbis, they say that he was a big masbid, a big Yerei Shamayim, and he learned so nicely. I mean, just switch around, you know? It's Rabbi X, Rabbi Y, Rabbi Z. He felt that's not what Hesper is about. He would point to Hespedim, which were given by his father-in-law, our Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, which were literally on point. There were appreciations of a particular individual for his particular greatness. Not the generalities and the platitudes, as true as they may be. He was a masvin, he was a reshamayim, all that's true. But he wanted to be a little bit more particular in evaluating the individual who has passed on, so we can learn more from him as an individual, as it means to you and me. So, in doing so, one has to speak from a particular personal perspective, which by definition is limited. I'm giving you my reminiscences, some of them, but this does not speak to the whole person. It's part of the inadequacy of this presentation. My first experience hearing Torah from Rabbi Lichtenstein Zatzal was exactly 50 years ago. At the beautiful and moving Hespedim, to me, the one that hit me the hardest was my chavrusa, Rabbi Ezra Bick. I believe it was the last Masbid. And he said, he entered Rav Lichtenstein Shia 50 years ago, and basically never left. He was fortunate, he entered the Shia when he was still in high school. I learned in a different high school. I did not go to MTA. By the time I came to the yeshiva, I was given advanced standing. That meant was, in Kamateka Bechina, with Rav Mendel Zaks, believe it or not, the son-in-law of the Chofetz Chaim, kid you not. And if he felt that you were an advanced student, especially if you were coming from a bit more yeshivish a place, I use my words carefully, so you often got advanced standing. So I was pushed to a second yeshir, and not to tell the story, I ended up pushing to a third yeshir. My first rebbe was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, one of our Rav Aaron's three rebbeim, whom you referred to, Rav Huttner, Rav Aaron, of course, primarily the Rav. So I skipped over Rav Lichtenstein. I saw him, knew who he was, but we had no, and I wasn't sitting in the chair. So in those years, you know, we were very, how should we say, chassidim of Beis Brisk. So I was learning Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was in the chair. During the summer, when the chair was basically closed, they had summer chair. Before all these kolos, before anything. And Rav Aaron Soloveitchik gave the summer chair. He gave it on Shabbos, summer of 1965. Finished my first year in the yeshiva. 66, Rav Aaron decided to leave to go to Chicago, and he asked Rav Lichtenstein to stay the summer shiur. So I went to the summer shiur to learn sukkah. Second parak, the sukkah is at the end of the second parak, the very beautiful lamdash of sukkahs. It was my first exposure to hear Rav Lichtenstein. Remember, that was a year after I had been 1 year in the Rav shiur. So it was a fascinating, I had Rav Aaron 1 year, then the Rav the next year, and now Rav Lichtenstein the summer after that. You know, for a young man to have the different streams within Beis Brisk was quite illuminating. I believe that of the three, Rav Lichtenstein is by far and away the most organized shiur. Rav Aaron, there were, he would just suddenly just go rattle off Gansa Marochas. My first day in the shiur, the first day, we learned Gittin. And he asked someone to read. The someone was Rabbi David Miller, who was my classmate. I was used to shiur in Yiddish. Everything's in English. And he's reading the Mishnah with the three, four toasts, and it's not the Rabbi Aaron's silent. What's this crazy yeshiva all about? Then he started talking about Akko. Toast is about Akko, the first toasts. So, okay, okay, let me say something. And he went for an hour straight with the Yisod. The first Yisod I heard in yeshiva. You probably heard it here. Shem Eretz Yisrael, Kedush Eretz Yisrael, Rabban printed this article later on. Akko what this and that, this here, that here. Oh, that was Rabban Soloveitch. That was how the whole year went, but this is Marochas would hear. The Rav was totally different. The Rav, he'd sit in the shiur, and he would just analyze everything. But either he made believe it was coming spontaneously, or it was coming spontaneously, I never knew for sure. But he was able to watch. Rav Aaron knew before he walked into the room what he was going to say. That's clear as day. The Rav, it wasn't clear. But he knew what he was going to say when he walked into the room. And if he did, he was a good actor, and he hit it. So you can see how the shiur has developed. But by definition, spontaneous or pseudo-spontaneous, it just flows. It's not so well organized. It's, you know, somebody asks a question, he goes, yeah, there. But Rav Aaron, Lichtenstein, says, I got the impression, like neither of those two, he knew exactly what I was going to say. But it wasn't just marochas. He'll just speak for an hour straight. Oh, no, not at all. We have a chakira, and he'd ask you to fill in the blanks. And, you know, he'd either agree with you or disagree with you. And it would go on like that. It was just masterpieces. That was my first interaction. Then, came back to the Rav Shir. Story. Then I finished college. And there was a kolo, meaning you didn't have to be married to be in the kolo, you still don't have to be in an yeshiva kolo. And Rav Aaron was the Rosh kolo. A whole different relationship. It's giving chabur, it's not shiurim. And he was a heroic figure for us as chavriya kolo. And he really, really tried, I don't know if he succeeded, in making himself as, quote, one of the boys. I remember like yesterday, the first opening meeting, we have the first, it was December of 68, first meeting of the call for the year, and he blurts out some Latin phrase, which they told me that it's first among equals. You assume you knew Latin, you know. It's a lot of things, you know. Well, Latin was one of them. And he treated himself as the first among equals. He didn't view himself as a Rosh Kola from on high. We're learning together, you know. So, yeah, okay, so I'm the Rosh Kola, but all right, but you know. And he really did care about everybody. And he was very insistent that every member of the Kol say a Chabura. He viewed the Chabura as being the growth mechanism of every young Talmud Chacham to be able to present ideas to an audience. Those days the Kol was pretty small, about 30 Chevra, but it was painfully clear to Rabban from the get-go that not all of these 30 people were capable of saying something respectable for all 30. So we divided the group into three. Remember yesterday. It was we'll call it Group A. Those were the 10 or so who could say a chavura for the whole group. And then there were the other 20 who, he wasn't mevatel, he had to say, but he only said within that little group. So the expression we used then for those were the basketball chavurus. Only 10 people in the room. And he'd say for the 10, and he'd go around. And the Group A, of which I was a member, had that too. And then we all had the privilege, or the challenge, of saying a chavura for the whole group in Rav Lichtenstein's full presence. If it was the basketball chavura day, he'd flip from one to the other. Remember the first chavura I ever said was in Cheskos Abatim, and he walked into me last. He went into the other two first, and he called me in the last 15 minutes. And of course, and here's the most beautiful thing, obviously he knew me, and he, after I said what I said, he missed the first part. He heard the last part. He said, why'd you say it this way? Maybe you should really say it a little differently. He was the ultimate constructive critic. He would sit there and take notes of what I'm saying. Can you imagine? He's a gadol of the Torah. He's taking notes of what a little kid is saying with full attention and full constructive criticism when you finish. So went on for 3 years. Cheskos Abatim. Then we learned Beitza, because he was into learning more too. And then we learned Ksubis. 3 years. After the third year, Rav Lichtenstein announced in the middle of the year, he's making Aliyah. He's going to Yeshivat Har Etzion. So I was privileged to be sitting at Rav Lichtenstein's feet, the last 3 years that he served as Rosh Kollel in America, in YU. I didn't know that going in. I don't think he knew it going in. Give me the last 3 years. But it was a special privilege. And I learned so much from him. Mentoring. Conservative mentoring. I'll just contrast this. I'm not making any comparisons. They're always odious. But in later development, it went to a different spin. The Chaburis ultimately petered out, and Bechinas substituted. Rabban had no Bechinas. He viewed the call as a graduate school. You didn't go Bechinas. You know, there's what to be said for each ways more accountability. This is more self-development. I'm just letting you know that there are choices that people make when they are involved in kolos. I was privileged, I'm again speaking on a personal note, when Rav Lichtenstein left Teretz Yisrael, the last Shabbos of the year, in those days we went to the end of June, the poster with the Scott and the Madaris, was a luncheon for Rav Lichtenstein. It was also for Rav Abramin's out. He also went up Aliyah at the same exact time. And I was the guest speaker. I lived in the neighborhood, Marsh Nights, I was already married by then. Rav Lichtenstein had a bracha under my wedding. Oh, Rav Lichtenstein. He tried to save my ksuba. How can I forget that? My ksuba, I mean, you'll laugh and hear the story. So my father, unbeknownst to me, asked a cousin of mine to write a fancy ksuba. And he wrote a ksuba, on a klaf, with ksav ashuris, and on top of the middle it said, Birivi. B'Shabbos, Rav said, puzzle. Why is it possible? What do you mean? Berevi, it's a bigger size. That's in the middle of the line. You can't have that. Rav Aaron is always trying to help out. Said, Rebbe, all the ksubas are that way. Go to the museums, the libraries. That's the only ksubas. The punchline of the story is the rabbi. A few words later, he found that the ksuba was mukdam by 100 years. And he smiled and said, "I told you it's possible." Hey, but Rav Lichtenstein was trying to save the day. My personal relationship with Rav Lichtenstein continued. And a story that he once told in his version when I was here for Shabbos at Shalosh Shudas. When he arrived in this country, he wanted to hire an American Rebbe. And since he knew me for so long, we had a correspondence. Of course, he wouldn't stand in Hebrew. There was no other way to correspond with Rav Lichtenstein. And he said, "You know what? Maybe you can come. There's we'll find you a dira, we'll set you up. You have to come for shiul dugma." So as it happened, my sister got married. It was, I'll give you the date, it's Rosh Chodesh Tammuz, 1973. I came that week to the yeshiva. It wasn't as big and beautiful as it was now. I met Rav Amital for the first time. I met Moshka. Did I say the name right?
Moshko.
Whatever it is, I don't know if I said it wrong, I asked Mechila. He showed me my house. You live right over here. He was a very practical man, I remember. And Rav Amital was sitting, I gave a shiur. Now, when I went to Karen B'Yavne, which was a number of years before that, I learned two things by presenting to the Israelis. Two things I learned right away. One, you have to speak faster than them. Otherwise, they're not going with you. You start speaking haltingly. Two, you have to roll your reish. Otherwise, but I learned the lessons well, and I rolled my rations, and I spoke quickly, and I thought it was a good shear. Rav Amital was very impressed, wanted to offer me a job right away. Rav Lichtenstein said, "Why did you start this way?" Nothing changed. I was so mamish. I remember like yesterday. He could have said this way. That his whole life was mentoring. His whole life. Now here's where the diverging stories about this my connection. Rav Lichtenstein, when he said it over at the Shalosh Shudas some years back, said, "You know, word got back to YU that I had offered a job to this rabbi and they wanted him to stay. So Rabbi Chalap offered him a job, so he shouldn't leave." Now Rabbi Chalap denies that story completely and absolutely. That he offered me a job and I never knew anything about my correspondence with Rav Lichtenstein. In any event, those were probably the two most difficult years of my life. I had now, from no jobs, I had two jobs. And it's hard to live with no jobs. I mean, I had a part-time job, but it's also hard to choose between two jobs. There were personal considerations which I can't go into right now. So we ended up staying, and I guess I say the rest is history. But my relationship with Lichtenstein will always remain with me. And, of course, it continued when I was... Well, I visited here, the next time I visited here, if I'm not mistaken, my wife and I attended the bar mitzvah of the present Rosh Hashiva, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein. If my years are right, it was the summer of 1974. We were here for a particular event. We were invited to the bar mitzvah, and we danced right here in this yeshiva. You tell me if the years work out right. That's my recollection. So the family ties go back. If we're talking about family, Rav Lichtenstein's mother taught my sister in Dover Elvi Yeshiva, Forest Hills. So that goes back, very long time. And of course, the Rav was my main Rebbe for 5 years. In the summers, I lived with the Rav. Once in a while, Rav Lichtenstein, who had his own shiur, would walk into the shiur by the Rav. And whenever the Rav needed some maramakum or something like that, Aaron, where is it, Aaron? And he always knew. I don't remember one case where he hesitated and said, he was like, the Rav that we can count on. Aaron, and right, boom, like a machine. He'd rattle off the appropriate source, and sometimes he asked questions and throw things in, in the middle of the shiur. We view this giant as someone who had mastered a significant corpus of secular knowledge, Harvard PhD in English, but as the Rambam said, he utilized it as the Rakochos and Tabochos and Ophos. He used it to enhance his knowledge of Torah, his presentation of Torah. He was very upfront about it. There was no hiding it. At the same time, individuals who viewed him as some kind of a Harvard intellectual missed the boat completely. I don't know if any of you were there at the Lava Malka we had on Motzei Shabbos in Gross, you were there? So Rabbi Berman Shlita, our new president, started by singing a song which he said was Rav Lichtenstein's favorite song. I was unaware of that. But the words to the song, Mama Hafti Sarasecha, Kol Hayom Yisichasi, which was favorite song, not favorite song. That's what he did all day. We never saw him with his English and Latin and Greek. He knew it. He quoted in his articles. I presume that he probably knew it about Peh from his younger years. And he utilized it to good effect. The same as his Rebbe the Rav did before him, quoting whatever knowledge he accumulated in Berlin and elsewhere, in presenting the Torah in a way which would be better appreciated by many. So to Rav Lichtenstein, he presented it in that fashion with his Bekiyas, as we'll say, in part of the secular culture. Sometimes, I say this, Lizchuso, he was such an idealist and was so driven to reach these ideals that some of the less edifying aspects of these cultures sort of passed them by. The best maramaka for this is a debate he had with a Harvard professor in Jewish Action, got his name, who was saying to Rav Lichtenstein, you know, when you went to Harvard, maybe you were able to do it that way, but today Harvard is a different kind of an institution. Not only an institution of higher knowledge, it's an institution where there's a complete lack of any propriety in gender relationships and things of this nature. It's a whole new world, and even the culture is now a low culture, it's not a high culture. So Rav Lichtenstein wrote back, if you're right, you're right. I can only describe what I know. That was part of him. He didn't see some of the negativity, and I think the reason is he didn't have an ounce of it in his body. In that respect, perhaps he was in a certain way like our Poisek in America or Moshe Feinstein, who was again such a noble soul that sometimes he didn't see some of the negativity because it just beyond his comprehension. And of course, that comes with consequences. It comes with consequences. When you're trying to reach and perfect an ideal, sometimes the real world is less than that ideal and can even go unnoticed sometimes. In Rav Lichtenstein Shiurim, as I'm sure those who have read his presented matter, you know there's a Chakira, and there's always a development in this way, that way. We said in the previous year, it could be this side, it could that, it could be both sides. And there was even a certain critique that at the end of the day, Rav Lichtenstein was not decisive. There was always, there's the one hand and there's the other hand. So it could be this way, it could be that way. So it leaves you hanging. Which way is it? If I'm not mistaken, I addressed this point at the Hesper that was given in Passaic, and I've got to correct me if I just don't remember. But I was very much in trying to insist and impart to the audience then, this is a gross oversimplification. It's true. The Rav Lichtenstein was very, very deferential to other opinions, those who disagreed with him. and he had great respect for so many streams of thought. One thing before I get into that, Rav Lichtenstein said so many times that he tried to have his Talmidim follow him insofar as they were connected not just to their local circle, but to the broader Klal Yisrael, which means both right and left. He was very desirous the Talmidim should have a connection to what he called the Olam HaYeshivot. In Arabic, we call it the Yeshiva Shevelt. We'll call it sometimes now the Black Hat Yeshivas. Just use that as a term. It doesn't mean anything. I think, with respect, he didn't succeed. I don't think that many of his Talmidim were able to establish the contact that he had. He had it in his bones. Rav Huttner was his Rebbe. He spoke about it so many times. He was out of touch with Rav Huttner who knows how many decades. But he passed away in 1980. But he never left him. And he wanted his Talmidim to have some modern day equivalent. Who was his main Rebbe when he came to America and left the Rav? Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Everyone knows that. Shlomo Zalman was a very broad person, but you know, he was Shalmi. He was Shtreimel. Didn't deter Rav Lichtenstein. He wanted his Talmidim to establish such relationships with people from that world. Don't know if he succeeded. From little that I know, I don't see everything. I don't have sometimes tunnel vision. One's not always able to emulate a Rebbe who's so great. And some of the Rebbe who's so great doesn't understand why you can't do it. I did it. Why can't you do it? Understand? Some of them has almost superhuman stamina and motivation. I did it. Why can't you do it? I guess in theory, rhetorically, yeah. But practically, no. that's an issue. It's something which you have to take into account. And, in the same context, Rav Lichtenstein's tolerance of other views was sometimes perhaps confused with acceptance of other views. As if he himself wanted it to be this way, just because he didn't excoriate individuals who had a different point of view. But that's a tricky premise. Sometimes, you know, you just allow something to happen, perhaps even permit something to happen, not that you necessarily want it to happen. And that nuance, I think, is also sometimes not appreciated. But getting back to I see my time is quite limited. I wanted to repeat what I said there, as it's a gross oversimplification, it's even a distortion, to assume that Rav Lichtenstein, because he was so even-handed and balanced, that, you know, there's always one hand, the other hand, nothing's really that black and white. You can never really come out strongly in a particular direction. If I'm not mistaken, I said then that in three areas, the three cardinal sins of Lichtenstein took very strong positions, very, very strong positions, for which he was castigated. Doesn't mean anything. If you're right, you're castigated. It's even the biggest puss. I remember some years ago, there was a situation which Rav Lichtenstein felt, and I believe, who am I believe 100% correctly, was shvichas damim in an unwarranted fashion. It had to do with damim of Einem Yehudim, but Rav Aaron felt that while we have to defend ourselves, everything has to have a balance. And when that line is crossed, and it's shvichas damim, which should never have happened, you have to speak out against it. Which he did. Very strongly. So you know how it is in this world. Rav Lichtenstein is a dove, and he doesn't understand the depth of the hatred of Esav Yaakov. What a mistake. He understood it as well as anybody else. But there's a limit. You can't just do whatever you want. There's no hefkeiros here. Everything has to be measured and balanced. Of course, we have to protect ourselves. You can't cross that line. And he was so strong. And if he asked me again, it's the part. So right. But you know, the people, I think some of them, even in this yeshiva, were critical of his position. It has something to do with the, you know, with the territories and things of this nature. I'm not sure what goes on here exactly, but it seems to me there are differing opinions even. And Rabban always encouraged that. He never didn't say Kavlu Daiti, you have to listen to me. That's Shri Chazam. And I remember, but I'll call it Avodah Zarah. What happened was, Rav Aaron would come every year to something called the Orthodox Forum. That's kind of a think tank of yeshivas and academics and shul rabbis. And there's no question, I went to many of these things. There was no one who could light a candle to Rav Aaron. He was the shining star of each and every annual meeting. It wasn't even close. And again, people would get up there to Shtusim V'Avolim. He said there was no pad, taking notes and everything. You know. And he came from the beginning to the end. You know, I would come, would go. It was one year after year. One year, a particular Jewish intellectual said something, which many of us thought was radically incorrect. But you know, what are you going to do? So this individual said that I think that my opinion is confirmed and endorsed from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. But I won't go into the details. That's what this individual said. And Rav Lichtenstein got up. These were his words. You there, Mesh? You were there, David? Correct if I'm not quoting it directly, word for word. If Rav Shlomo Zalman would read what you wrote and hear what you said, he would Reis Kriya. He'd rip his arms. Blasphemous. That's the only Orthodox forum that never went to print. They couldn't print it with this article. They didn't want to print it without this article. I was there for that exchange. So he couldn't tolerate, with all his liberalism and all his, you know, his broad-mindedness, across a line to hear from him. And even more recently, talk about Gili Arias. There was a particular individual, and again, I'm not mentioning names, who was apparently, and again, I have no first-hand knowledge, but based on reliable evidence, doing things Maisim Ashalo Yeyosu. Is it called Forum Takana? Is that what it's called? They went, did a job, they did the research, and Rav Lichtenstein was either a member or a consultant, and he came out very strongly against an individual who was extraordinarily charismatic. And had a following. I think still has a following. And he went all out. No one hand, the other hand, none of that business. Full. For which he was castigated by groupies of this charismatic individual, one of whom was someone whom I knew, and I was very upset. And that's when I went myself to meet with the chairperson of this forum, Takana, lives in America, the Rav Cook, found the Rav, it's the same, I think. I went to the house, I was here for Sukkot, I know the year. It was 2010. I went to the house to discuss how we can defend Rav Lichtenstein's cut. So therefore, appreciating his ability to be so strong-willed, strong-minded, strongly expressing what he thought was right. At the same time, almost always, he was polite and deferential and tolerant. It wasn't coming from a point of weakness. He's a pussycat, doesn't want to rock the boat. No! I gave you three boats that he rocked. At the same time, he was gentle and understanding, and people who were much, much lesser light than he accorded them respect, treated them with dignity. This only enhances the greatness of this giant. A giant in Torah, a giant in Midas Tovas, a giant in Tefillah. I remember, I think I'm past my time, I ended with one story. So the Rav, Zechron and the Rav, would talk about Rosh Hashanah night as Koronatia Nacht. And he would describe so vividly how we have to have the coronation of a Kodesh Baruch Hu in Rosh Hashanah. Okay, I heard it many times. Rav Lichtenstein's last year in America, I was privileged to daven with him Rosh Hashanah night. So you know, we davened, it wasn't such a short Shemot Esrei. And after that, we said L'David Mizmor, and Aleinu, and L'David, and Kaddish, and then everyone went around to say to the Rosh Hashiva, say good Shana Tova, this took who knows how long, and we finally left, Rav Lichtenstein was still davening Shemot Esrei. He took tefillah and the Rav's concept seriously. And I say, now that Rav Lichtenstein has left us to a higher place, he's still down in Shemot Esrei. There's no question that he's up there being Mamlech HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with all the tremendous chusin that he had, with all the unbelievable Torah that he learned, all those hours upon hours, days upon days, Kol Hayom Yisichasi, with all the bizyonis that he took, and he never responded. He never responded when they attacked him from all sides. Never. Now he followed his Rebbe, the Rav. With all the, we say at the end of the Torah, the Yada Chazaka, when it was necessary to do what he did, Le'ene Kol Yisrael, despite the critiques, all this is accompanying him, no doubt, to the, we call the Lichter Gan Eden, to the higher world of light and of peace and of knowledge. The world that he inhabited here on this earth, and that he inhabits in much greater measure in Shemayim. Tehei nishmasa tzerura b'tzorachai.